Welcome to the Ringer Podcast Network. Season 8 of Game of Thrones premiered on Sunday, and you can deep dive with the Ringer staff as we make our way through the final episodes of the series. On the podcast side, listen to Binge Mode Game of Thrones with Mallory Rubin and Jason Concepcion, The Watch with Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald, and a pre-cappable series on the Recappables feed where we'll make predictions on episodes to come. In addition to our Sunday night Twitter after show called Talk the Thrones, we'll be releasing tons of videos over the course of the series. So make sure to check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRinger. And for even more Game of Thrones coverage, head over to theringer.com.
Welcome to Game of Thrones Precappables, part of the Ringer Podcast Network. This is the podcast where we preview the Thrones episode to come, and today, battle is nigh as we break down what to expect in Season 8, Episode 2. I'm Zach Cram, and joining me as always, on the back of a dragon with no harness and no saddle, he's just got to hang on tight and fly, it's Riley McAtee. Riley!
Let's go, man. We're into it.
As those of you who joined us last week know, we're going to break this episode down into a couple segments. And this time, unlike last week, we actually got a teaser segment at the end of last week's episode. We got a minute of scenes of quotes from next week. So let's break that down with our first segment next on Game of Thrones. Riley, you want to break down this first quote we see in the trailer?
Yeah, so the teaser opens with Daenerys talking clearly to Jaime, saying, "When I was a child, my brother would tell me a bedtime story about the man who murdered our father, about all the things we would do to that man." This is one of the interesting first points of tension that we're going to get in Winterfell in this episode, which is Jaime is the Kingslayer, famously, and the king was Dany's dad. And his act in killing Aerys, the Mad King, is really what set her on the run for her entire childhood, which is, you know, truly traumatic. She was running from city to city, in Essos with her brother, begging just to get by, running away from hired knives, you know, assassins trying to kill her. So obviously she's not going to take too kindly to Jaime.
And to go with those bedtime stories she references in the quote, at least in the book, there are a couple instances in the first book when Viserys, Dany's brother, is still alive, where we actually get a reference to what those bedtime stories are. The first one is that Viserys tells her stories about, quote, "the polished skulls of the last dragons staring down sightlessly from the walls of the throne room while the Kingslayer opened father's throat with a golden sword." Obviously painting Jaime in the worst possible light, making him seem as treacherous as a lot of people in the realm really think he was at that point. That's why he gets the moniker Kingslayer, because he went against his sworn vow as a member of the Kingsguard. And the fact that the last dragons were staring down at him, I think, reinforces Dany's connection to her ancestors at this point. Another quote from Viserys is he would tell Dany, and I'll quote here, "I shall kill the usurper myself," referring to Robert, "as he killed my brother Rhaegar, and Lannister too, the Kingslayer, for what he did to my father." Now, Viserys, of course, never killed anyone, and he never really had either the means or ability to. Dany does now. She is the queen. She has thousands of soldiers at her command. She has two dragons whom she has used to commit political executions before. I think we both would doubt that that will be the result for this seeming trial that Jaime is on here, but there's a lot of tension.
Yeah, what a sweet, sweet bedtime story from Viserys. Hey, little sister, let's talk about the man who murdered our father and what we'll do to him once we get him.
But it does bring up another question, I think, which is Dany, at least in this one line, seems pretty pissed about the Kingslayer opening her father's throat. But maybe this is where Sam's reaction to his father dying last week kind of sets the stage, where Sam had no real warm feelings for his father, but he was still upset to learn that he had died.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, and the way that Sam had a kind of measured response, at least while he was in Daenerys's presence, to that, in that, you know, he didn't like blow up at her, or he didn't get too angry. He just got sad and respectfully kind of removed himself from that situation, might color also how Daenerys acts in this situation. It's also worth noting that, you know, Dany can be upset about the man who killed her father, but she's also spent almost her entire adult life saying that she's not her father and distancing right. herself from him. So it's a little like, okay, how upset can you really be?
And Jamie will also, at least for his sake, come bearing news. He is the person who knows that Cersei is reneging on her deal, which Tyrion just spent an hour telling people, no, no, no. I know you don't trust Cersei, but believe me, she won't
be
a
traitor.
And of course, we'll soon be proven wrong. So it'll be interesting to see that brotherly connection there, because that leads into the next quote from the trailer where Daenerys says he, referring to Tyrion, we presume, should have never trusted Cersei. And Sansa says, you never should have either.
Yeah, I mean, this seems like it's just got to be about Tyrion, who, you know, really has kind of lost his edge a little bit as the mastermind, and then is going to find out immediately that Cersei has betrayed him, as we all could have seen coming.
I wonder if Jaime's approach here, I assume he will apologize for pushing Bran out of a tower.
Apologize for a lot of things, I guess.
But seeing, I think the moment where at the end of last episode, he and Bran see each other from across the Winterfell courtyard, even though they didn't say any words, was really powerful, because there were so many parallels in that first episode to the pilot of the entire series and how everyone arrived at Winterfell and so on. But this was, I think, the most direct connection, where that's how the first episode of the show ended, Jaime pushing him out of the tower. And then we see them sort of reconnect for the first time. Jaime will have to apologize for that, but then he can also hold that information card. I'll be very interested to see how he approaches this meeting, where it really, at least the staging from the trailer, looks like he's going to be on trial in front of the assembled lords, kind of like Littlefinger was at the end of last season.
Yeah, I actually wonder if it will be Bran who can sort of vouch for him, as well as possibly Brienne, possibly Tyrion, and can kind of say, you know, Jaime has changed. It's not the same. I just think that Bran himself won't really care that much. I think he, at this point, sees that becoming the Three-Eyed Raven was his destiny, and that being pushed and ultimately being paralyzed was part of that path. So I actually think that most of the skepticism will probably come from characters like Jon and Sansa and obviously Daenerys that we see in this teaser.
Again, like we saw at the beginning of this last episode, they're all making their pleasantries in the courtyard as Jon's introducing Dany and he's saying, oh, hi, Bran, it's been so long. And Bran just basically goes, yeah, we don't have time for any of this. So these internecine human squabbles he might be past at this point, I hope they like wheel him inside for this, because he basically spent all of the first episode in the courtyard.
He's getting cold.
Yeah. And I hope they can help him out and sort of receive that help in return. Do you think that the Jaime moment will just come at the beginning of the episode and then they'll move past it and get ready with the battle preparations? That's sort of how the trailer seems to set it up. And as big and grand as this moment appears to be, I can't imagine it takes up that much of the episode.
I wouldn't be surprised if it is toward the beginning of the episode, and then as Jaime's kind of on trial and they're all sort of arguing about this, that might be the moment when like Tormund and Beric and Ed arrive, and it kind of, if it's undecided what to do with Jaime, the urgency of the situation shifts to what they have to relay, which is that the White Walkers are coming. There's possibly only like a day left to prepare. And then they kind of are like, all right, Jaime, like, here's a sword. I guess, you know, we all need to just fight together. You know, Jon said in season 7 at one point, when they weren't sure where Beric, Thoros, and the Hound lied as far as like whether they could trust them or not, Jon was just like, well, we're all on the same team because we're all breathing. And I think they'll probably have a similar moment with Jaime.
That's a good point, and leads into the next quote from the trailer, which is from Arya. She says, death, it's got many faces. I look forward to seeing this one. Arya, very familiar with death, very familiar with a cult that surrounds the prospect. What do you think this specific quotation refers to?
Yeah, we also got this quote in the trailer like a month or so ago. We can see in that trailer when she actually says it too, and she's holding kind of a what looks like a dragonglass dagger, or it might be whatever dragonglass weapon she's having Gendry make for her. But I believe she's talking about the White Walkers and the Night King here, and is kind of setting up that battle a little bit.
The reaction from the characters who have yet to encounter the dead and have yet to fight the dead is a really interesting one, because Arya seems really cocksure at this point, and as well she should be. She's the best killer in the region. She bested Brienne in a sparring duel last season, and it's not like she has really had any reason to be afraid since killing the Waif and completing her Faceless Man training. She, at least in this line, reflects confidence that she's going to be able to handle what is coming. But then again, in that season 8 trailer, we saw her sprinting with what looked like fear in her eyes. It seems like in this coming battle, some characters who are pretty sure of themselves will have reason for doubt for the first time in a while.
She's also, it's not even that she's just never even seen death. She's never been in a battle before. It's very different to be in a one-on-one duel, especially like something where you're sparring with Brienne or you're battling the waif who is like literally exactly your own size, you know, which is to say small. A completely different thing to be in a full-blown, you know, hundreds, thousands of people fighting all around, like in a brawl. So yeah, Arya's a little confident here. I have a feeling that she won't be so confident once we really get into the Battle of Winterfell.
It's not just Arya. Maisie Williams, I believe, had a quote in one of her preseason profiles where she said that as an actress, she was really excited to finally join a battle scene. So I'm sure that will be coming, maybe not this episode, but at least in the one after. The next image we see in the trailer is about a different weapon. Jorah looks at a sword as he's unsheathing it. We got a hint about this in the season 8 trailer, and this really seemed to confirm this is Heartsbane, the Tarly family sword that Sam stole from Randall when he left his father's castle.
Yeah, if you pause the screenshot, if you look closely at it, you can tell it matches up with exactly what Heartsbane looks like. So we can presume that Sam, who is not really going to wield Heartsbane, not really a warrior, gives that sword to Jorah for this fight.
Why do you think he gives it to Jorah, who at one point held the Valyrian steel sword? Longclaw was his. It was House Mormont's before he gave it back when he had to flee the country. Why do you think Heartsbane is going to end up going to Jorah?
I feel like I might give it to the Hound if it were me, though I'm not sure. So, you know, Jorah is kind of the longest serving ally of Dany, who, as we just covered, literally murdered Randall and Dickon Tarly, Sam's brother and father. And, you know, it feels weird to then hand over this priceless, treasured family heirloom to him, even if the sword does have to go to somebody who can use it. It's also worth noting that in the books, Heartsbane is described as being a two-handed greatsword, which is kind of similar to Ice, which was the Stark family sword that Ned wielded in the first season, which is to say it's huge, it's super unwieldy for actual combat. But based on the way that we see Jorah holding it and what we saw when Sam stole it, it looks like they've scaled it down a little bit for the show. It might be a little bit more useful and able to be used in combat and everything. The reason that I say I would give it to the Hound is that he has that great line in, I believe, season 4, where he says he always wanted some Valyrian steel. So, and he's a big guy. He could definitely wield Heartsbane, but Jorah will be good for it.
I did like the look of that dragonglass axe that Gendry made for him last episode, though.
Yeah, that's true. He got his own badass weapon.
And who knows, maybe Jorah and Sam just had a really great bonding session as Sam like peeled away half of his skin. That seemed like it took a while because it took like a full 2 or 3 minutes just to remove one of his scales. They probably had a lot to talk about.
It's kind of a one-way relationship though, you know? I mean, Sam cures Jorah of grayscale and now he also gives him a Valyrian steel sword and it's like, hey, Jorah, maybe help Sam out with something here soon.
We also then go to Jon back in the crypts, but this time instead of talking to Sam, it looks like he's talking to Daenerys. I wonder if that is where he decides to reveal the news he learned at the end of last episode, that he is the heir to the Iron Throne. He didn't seem all that eager to reveal that news or even to accept it himself when he talked to Sam. But what else would they have to talk about in the crypts?
Yeah, I wonder if Dany just comes down there and is like, hey, John, you keep hanging around this statue of your aunt all the time now. And he just has to be like, well, look, I gotta spill the beans to you. I imagine they're down there. It looks like they're in front of Lyanna's statue. I have to imagine that he says, you know, hey, here's what I just found out.
And I was a little underwhelmed in John's flight on Rhaegal last episode. It seemed a little too quick and easy, even though congratulations, your prediction was right. But I wonder if that will become useful here, because it's unlikely that they will just believe, oh, you know, this whole thing you've believed your whole life that you were the heir to the Seven Kingdoms, actually that's wrong. And this guy you're in love with is not only a relative, but he has a better claim than you. I wonder if John can use that as a point of evidence. Hey, I was able to ride a dragon. In the inside the episode at the end of last episode, one of the showrunners said that only Targaryens can ride dragons, and we presume Dany knows this. So that made it a little odd in the moment when she was urging Jon to ride, because if she knew that, then why would she expect Jon to be able to mount Rhaegal? But if she does know that, then at this point, in retrospect, it could end up helping bridge the gap between what she wants to believe and what she kind of has to.
I mean, that's a little bit more established in the books, right? That you need Valyrian ancestry in order to bond with a dragon. And it felt like that moment should have had the gears turning in Dany's mind, being like, wow, like this is literally like the second person to ride a dragon in 100 or 150 years. That's pretty wild. But, you know, maybe those gears get turning in this episode.
And after their conversation, we see a lot of assorted odds and ends. We see Arya shooting a bow and arrow. We see some sort of trebuchet throwing a projectile that looks like a giant hunk of rock. We see Grey Worm and Missandei kissing in the yard. We see nervous people sort of staring into the beyond from the Winterfell battlements and from the yard. And then we get to this final quote. But before the final quote, did anything from those really quick flashes of imagery get you excited or wondering what might happen with any of those?
I love that we get Arya with what appears to be the dragonglass-tipped bow and arrow because, you know, one of the fun little things always watching this show has been that in the books, Arya never actually, like, wields a bow and arrow. She thinks about it. She kind of wants to learn how. In the show, they have her do that in, you know, season one, episode one. And she later then learns more with the Brotherhood about banners, about how to shoot. And now she really gets to put those skills to the test.
And it looks like if you pause the first episode when she's showing Gendry the diagram of her proposed weapon, that isn't an arrow. That looks more like a spear.
Yeah.
So as she tells Jon and Gendry, she already has needle. She already has the Valyrian steel dagger. She's getting a bow and arrow, maybe tipped with dragonglass. She's getting this spear that Gendry is going to make her. She's just going to be fully stocked and armed and able to use all sorts of weaponry. I'm excited to see what comes of all those weapons she's collecting.
Yeah, she's ready to go. I mean, the battle is coming to her, but she's ready.
The battle will presumably come, but will it come in this episode? Jon says in the trailer, how long do we have? Tormund says, before the sun comes up tomorrow. Episode 3, we've been thinking all along, is going to be the big Winterfell battle episode because that is the really long episode, the first one of the season, and it's directed by Miguel Sapochnik, who will be directing the big Winterfell battle. Do you anticipate the battle will start in this episode in any fashion, and then episode 3 will contain the bulk of it? Or do you really think this will just be the preparation, and then it'll lead directly into episode 3? We'll basically have to wait a week for the battle to start.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think that it'll be all prep in this episode. There'll be a lot of urgency. There'll be a lot of, you know, getting ready. And then I think, you know, the sun will start to go down as we kind of see in this teaser. And I think it'll be right when the battle is going to break out, which could set up an episode 3 that is like literally nothing but a battle, which would be kind of wild.
And you know what? That kind of excites me. I'm a sucker for a good battle preparing montage with people training and getting ready and setting up defenses and discussing battle strategy. I like that sort of thing. I think Thrones has moved away from that a little bit, where like Beyond the Wall, they didn't really have any battle strategy last season. So I'm excited to see that again after such highs as like Blackwater, where we saw the work of the preparation actually go into a magnificent episode. So even if the battle doesn't arrive yet this week, I think it could still definitely be an appealing hour of television and set up the next episode to be even brighter.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think sometimes the stuff that happens outside of a battle, like before it, is more interesting than the fighting itself. So this could be a really good episode.
And before we move on to the next segment, the theory of the week, we're going to take a break for a quick word from our sponsor, because Oreo has teamed up with Game of Thrones to create limited edition packaging and cookies embossed with the sigils of 3 remaining contending houses, as well as the symbol of the Night King. So in this segment, we're going to pick a sigil and recap what happened to that house in this episode. Today, we're going to talk about House Targaryen, which had maybe a small number of characters, but a pretty important first episode. So this episode begins with Dany, the last remaining, at least she believes, Targaryen, arriving to a frosty reception in the north, both from the commoners, whose sour looks turn to fright when they see dragons for the first time, and from Sansa and the assembled northern lords. And then Dany tells Sam that she executed his father and brother, adding more evidence to the theory that she's more like her father than anyone would like.
Suddenly, we're going to get a doubling in the population of House Targaryen because Sam tells Jon that Jon is, in fact, the son of Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark, making him a trueborn Targaryen and the heir to the Iron Throne. Jon also rides Rhaegal in this episode. And, you know, as we learned in the Inside the Episode segment, only Targaryens can ride dragons. So it seems like in this episode two, they're going to establish firmly for all the rest of the characters that Jon is in fact a Targaryen, and that the house is not necessarily doomed with Dany and can continue and can grow beyond this season.
And Dany also learns her dragons aren't eating because they don't like the North. They only have a small size breakfast, and she's concerned about what it's going to do to them in this climate, because they've spent all their lives basically in warmer climates, in the Dothraki Sea, in Meereen, in Dragonstone, which is wet and damp, but at least isn't cold like this. So Dany learns about that. It's a tense time for House Targaryen, which only has a few remaining members. Thanks to Oreo, and head to Oreo.com and pledge your fealty to the house or Night King of your choice. Tune in to Game of Thrones on Sundays on HBO, where we're sure to learn a lot more about those houses, including the Targaryens, this coming Sunday. And that leads perfectly into the theory of the week, because we're going to dive deeper into the why of Dany's dragons not eating and what it might mean for future episodes. This is a theory that hasn't been discussed as much because there were so many takeaways after Sunday's episode, including and most especially the conversation that Jon has with Sam. But that isn't the only Targaryen-based intrigue that comes out of that episode. We kind of get the idea that maybe, and this leads into our theory, dragons are not just uncomfortable with the North, but actively repelled by it, repelled by the cold, possibly even repelled by the White Walkers. What did we learn about that this episode, Riley?
Yeah, so one of the Dothraki rides up to Daenerys, and she's immediately concerned. They're clearly talking about an ongoing issue, which is that the dragons have only eaten 18 goats and 11 sheep. It seems like it's like mid-morning at that point, but apparently this qualifies as the dragons barely eating, you know, just a light breakfast, a little snack, and it seems unhealthy. And this is when, so Jon and Dany go to the dragons to go check them out. And John's kind of like, well, what's wrong? And Dany says, they don't like the North. And that's it. That's kind of where we leave it. At that point, you know, John rides Rhaegal. They go do their thing. But we never return to this idea of like, what's wrong with the dragons? Why aren't they eating? What is it that they don't like about the North? So that's what we want to dive into here.
And frankly, if only 18 goats and 11 sheep in a day is a bad sign, then I kind of understand Sansa saying, how are we possibly expected to feed everyone? Like, that could probably sustain a good portion of Unsullied soldiers for
perhaps
a while.
Perhaps when Sansa asked what dragons eat, Dany should just said, like, literally everything, all of it. They're going to eat all the food that you have. 18 goats and 11 sheep? Holy cow.
You're right. They kind of drop it after that because Dany and John just shoot doe eyes at each other instead. and it doesn't come back up again. It's a little unclear in the moment. Obviously, Dany's concerned, but we don't know if she actually plans to do anything about it. There is some evidence that previous Targaryen dragons have fared poorly in the North. A lot of the evidence comes from Fire and Blood, which is the book of Targaryen history that George R. R. Martin released last year. And interestingly, in the press run around this book, he told Esquire, quote, "This is a book that Daenerys might actually benefit from reading. Maybe if she understood a few more things about dragons and her own history in Essos, things would have gone a little differently." Now, this is obviously referencing the past, but I think we can take from this Martin quote to mean there are some lessons in here that could inform Dany's future, too. And there are two key instances of dragons being in the North that we thought were relevant. The first one is about the good queen, Alysanne, who was a beloved queen married to King Jaehaerys, and they had a great partnership ruling in Westeros. And they visited the North, King Jaehaerys atop his dragon, Queen Alysanne atop hers. And she wrote in a letter after this visit, quote, "Thrice I flew Silverwing, her dragon, high above Castle Black, and thrice I tried to take her north beyond the wall. But every time she veered back south again and refused to go. Never before has she refused to take me where I wished to go. I laughed about it when I came down again so the Black Brothers would not realize anything was amiss. But it troubled me then, and it troubles me still." And then we also get another example from Prince Jacerys, who was a prince during the Dance of Dragons, the one we talked about last episode, who might have deposited some dragon eggs in Winterfell. And he visited Winterfell atop his dragon Vermax, and Fire and Blood gives the quote, "Snow and ice and cold made Vermax ill-tempered, so the prince did not linger long amongst the Northmen." Interesting, given that Dany is now planning to make an extended stand in the North.
Yeah, it's well known that Targaryens do not often travel north, and it might be because like their dragons really do not prefer the cold. We also know that dragons are, you know, sort of temperamental creatures. They have limits to their comfort. You know, we've always seen Drogon has been a little bit like that. I like to think that they're kind of the cats of Westeros. Other than actual cats, dragons are, you know, very cat-like creatures. In the finale to season 7, Daenerys says as they're visiting the dragon pit that, quote, "This place was the beginning of the end for my family. A dragon is not a slave. They were terrifying, extraordinary. They filled people with wonder and awe, and we locked them in here. They wasted away, they grew small, and we grew small as well. We weren't extraordinary without them. We were just like everyone else." So it's kind of well established that dragons, you know, they need to roam free, and they also need to be in whatever their comfortable habitat is, and it appears that that's not the north.
And we know, because of this Daenerys quote, that she knew that about her family, yet when she was in Meereen, she locked the dragons up anyway, knowing that it would stunt their growth. There's a reason that Drogon is the most powerful, at least it seems, of the three dragons right now, because he was the one who wasn't locked under a pyramid for a couple seasons on end. So it's interesting that Daenerys would basically ignore that history lesson. And then here, it's kind of more mandatory that she has to take her dragons north because the humans don't really have a chance against the White Walker's army without them. But it's not great that she has that precedent. We know on the show that this isn't entirely as true as it is in the books, because in the Beyond the Wall episode, her dragons were able to go beyond the wall. So it's not like the example with Silverwing from Fire and Blood, where the dragon refused. We saw those dragons go beyond the wall. Of course, one of them was killed and enslaved or reanimated into the Night King's army, so that wasn't great. But it isn't as seeming a limit necessarily in the shows. But they had to bring this up for a reason in the first episode, right? There's so little time left on the show, they wouldn't add that little hint or that little subplot in if it weren't going to pay off in future episodes.
Yeah, I tend to think that Dany's dragons were able and comfortable with going beyond the wall because that was a true emergency. You know, she was going up with a lot of urgency. And Alysanne's dragon maybe didn't go north because she was just trying to go exploring, and that dragon was like, no way, it's too cold, or there's just some reason to not go beyond the wall. The dragon was like, unless I absolutely have to, it's not happening. And now it feels like the show is circling back to that and exploring why it is the dragons are uncomfortable with the north. And it might just be the cold, but I tend to think that there might also be something else going on as well.
Right, because the dragons are a really fascinating mix of phenomenal physiology, but also magic. Magic is part of their core and part of their powers. And we know that there's different magic in the north. There are different gods in the north, for one. I'm not sure how much that affects things, but it does lend credence to like a yin-yang theory of the White Walkers on one hand and the dragons on the other, ice and fire. And yes, this is the Song of Ice and Fire, but those are dissonant elements in most interpretations. So there might be something there, and I wonder how this will affect the battle. This is a really interesting question because, as you have pointed out before, we don't see Dany and her dragons in really any of the trailers actually fighting. Do you think this affects their ability to participate in the Battle of Winterfell?
I'm not sure. I don't think that they'll be available for the battle because we haven't seen them, and we'll kind of talk about that a little later. But I do think that there's a chance that Viserion, as the kind of not really an ice dragon, but either the white dragon or the White Walker dragon, we're not really sure, has an upper hand here in the sense that he should theoretically be very comfortable with the cold. He is basically, you know, now an ice creature, sort of, whereas the dragons are still a fire creature. And so they're outside of like their natural habitat where they're going to be most comfortable. And so it could be the case that even if there are two dragons on Dany's side and one dragon on the Night King's side, that two of those dragons are, you know, lethargic and anemic and out of their element, whereas the one dragon is fighting at full force.
And I think we've seen in the show before that geography can affect magical ability. We saw all the way in Qarth back in season 2, they say that the presence of dragons amplifies their powers. We know that certain powers in the north work better next to weirwood trees. We know that this is more in the books than the show, but warging does better in the north. So there are all these hints leading up to this moment that climate and surroundings matter when it comes to magical abilities. So I wonder if the dragons won't be as effective in battle in the north because of the cold, especially, like you said, fighting Viserion basically on his home turf. It got me thinking, like, yes, one of the dragons died from one of the Night King's spears, but that wasn't really an aerial battle. The dragons haven't had an aerial battle at this point, and they haven't come up against creatures that can really go toe-to-toe with them. So when Viserion presumably goes up against one of his brothers, that'll be a moment of awakening for both Dany and her children. And it could be like an Arya thing where she has been so invincible for so long that it could be a wake-up call. And I know we disagree here a little bit. You think the dragons might not participate at all in the Battle of Winterfell. I could see them participating and seeing Viserion basically romp because he's on his home turf.
Yeah, I just feel like you still have to have the dragons around. So, you know, perhaps Viserion can wound Rhaegal or Drogon, but not kill them or not, you know, disable them. Basically, it's a delicate balance. But I definitely think that Daenerys, you know, she kind of brushed off Bran when he told her that Viserion has been risen by the Night King. And I think that they're not really fully aware of what they're in for.
Yeah, they didn't see that. The last they saw of Viserion was him falling beneath the ice. They don't know the powers he has. We don't entirely know the powers he has. We don't really know if he is a white that was just reanimated by the Night King and controlled by him, or if he's actually kind of like the White Walker, where he might have some agency of his own. But I would expect to see the dragons struggling somewhat, or else this kind of reference to the dragons not eating in the north wouldn't really have any place over the course of the full season.
Some other points that kind of maybe foreshadow some of this is that Aegon the Conqueror never actually went north. He conquered the north when Torrhen Stark knelt. Torrhen Stark came south and kind of saw the destruction that the dragons were causing and said, you know what? We want no part of that. I will be the king who knelt, and we will give up the north and pledge our fealty to Aegon and this new Targaryen dynasty. But Aegon never actually ventured north, had no interest in really exploring it. And then in this Fire and Blood book, the first character named Daenerys Targaryen, this is a character who died about 60 years after Aegon's invasion, died to something called the Shivers, which killed her in about a day and a half. And so this is a character that George R. R. Martin has invented quite recently, and I just don't think that that bodes well for Daenerys.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Dany will die of this disease that looks sort of like the flu, almost, and originates in cold places. And I have to think there's some reason that George R. R. Martin invented this character who had never been referenced even on timelines, even on family trees, until last year. George R. R. Martin had to come up with this character for some reason, and it stands out. I'm not sure if that will translate to the show, but while we're discussing struggles that Targaryens have in the North, I think it's certainly worth a mention that Daenerys's original namesake died of something that originated in the cold.
Yeah, I think it's George R. R. Martin trying to tip his hand a little bit to the idea that Targaryens and the cold just don't really mix.
They don't, and we will surely find out next episode if there's more to this story or if it was just sort of dropped in the middle of nowhere.
I can't imagine that detail is dropped in the middle of nowhere for nothing.
I think you're right, and it really, I hadn't considered this theory much before the episode because so many of the details were confined just to the books. But now it seems like there might be more crossover than we had initially anticipated.
Yeah, I'm all in. I think that there's something about the dragons in the north that don't gel, and we'll learn more in this episode.
So the next segment we're going to get to moves away from the Targaryens a bit. We're getting to the keys to the game, where we're each going to pick a key player for this episode and lay out three keys for how they can achieve their goals and ambitions. Riley, who's your key player this episode?
My key player is Arya. So first off, I was just so happy with the way that her character was written for episode one, which is really a key for me less than it is a key for Arya. I felt like the writers did a really good job of balancing Arya, the character we know and we love in the early seasons, with kind of the no one assassin that she became in the later seasons. She kind of has to have both. I felt like in season seven, she was a little too much of no one and not enough of Arya. But in this episode, she had fun. She was smiling. She kind of sort of flirted with Gendry. And so I just want to shout out the writers, man. It was so refreshing. That was the most fun I've had with Arya since maybe season four. As for Arya going forward, we have not seen her meet Daenerys yet. And as a child, Arya always admired female warriors. She named her direwolf Nymeria, due to the famous Rhoynar princess who came to Westeros and conquered Dorne. She has that scene in season 2 where she talks to Tywin about Rhaenys and Visenya, the two sister wives of Aegon the Conqueror, and she can recall the names of their dragons, Meraxes and Vhagar. And when Daenerys came in this episode, Arya was in awe at the two dragons flying overhead, even as all the other Northerners were cowering in fear and freaking out. So we still haven't gotten the Arya-Daenerys interaction, and I think that that's really key, not only for Arya's character, because she gets to see, you know, this new female queen who has dragons, who has all this power and might, somebody who Arya might potentially really look up to, but also Arya is sort of in the middle of this kind of growing tension between Sansa and Daenerys with Jon in there, and kind of where Arya comes out on all that. You know, she says to Jon, Sansa's fighting for our family. You know, you're our family too. Don't forget that, all that. Kind of makes her an interesting player as this sort of human conflict plays out in Winterfell.
She could be Dany's best bet for an ally in the North, which she is in desperate need of.
Potentially, yeah, yeah. I mean, it would be, if Daenerys and Arya cannot have sort of the like rivalry that Daenerys has with Sansa, that would be really cool to see. Perhaps Arya can unlock even a different side of Daenerys, something that's a little bit more fun and interesting and admirable about her as well. And then my final key for Arya is, we've kind of already been over a little bit, but we're about to see her in her first ever battle, you know, and the weapon that she asked Gendry to make looked like a spear. If you pause the show and you look closely, you can see that she's labeled the tip Dragonglass. So obviously it's a weapon that's somehow supposed to kill White Walkers or, you know, whites or whatever. But it also looks like there might be some kind of projectile component to this. There's kind of two parts of it with an arrow. It's really unclear what exactly it is. If it's just a dragonglass tipped spear, that's fine. But it also might be something a little more creative than that. And I think seeing her wield that in her first battle will be really fascinating.
And one of the folks who helped design that weapon behind the scenes, I saw, gave an interview with Vanity Fair after Sunday's episode and called it a showstopper of a weapon.
Oh, wow.
So there are already so many cool weapons she has, like we talked about, that for this one to even go above and beyond that is quite tantalizing.
She is loaded. All right, Zach, what's your key?
My key player is Tyrion, who is in a bit of a slump lately. So my first key for him is to rebound and get his groove back quickly after he learns the repercussions of trusting Cersei, because presumably Jaime's going to reveal it. Everyone's going to be mad at him for thinking that he had negotiated a deal. But to be of any use to Dany going forward, he has to break out of this, because basically the schemers and plotters have been kind of neutered of late. Littlefinger's dead. Varys hasn't done anything of use since helping Dany come west. Tyrion's the only remaining one, it seems, who might be able to help swing the tide of this war. So I hope he's able to rebound. Number two is to advise Dany with caution if and when Jon reveals his parentage to her, because she won't be happy. And as Varys warned last season, and as Tyrion told Cersei when they met, it's kind of up to him to keep her fiery impulse in check. Cersei says, you would follow someone who burns her enemies? And Tyrion says, well, she knows her weaknesses, and picks an advisor who can help her keep it in check. That's almost his job. And this might be the greatest test of that yet, when Dany learns this long-held secret. And number three, I think, is most important in the short term for him to recapture some of that early season tactical magic. Because we don't really know yet who's engineering Winterfell's defensive strategy. This is what we mentioned earlier. I'm really excited to see in this coming episode, and I hope I see some actual battle preparations. I don't want to be fully surprised in the third episode to see what defenses Winterfell has to come up with. If you look at the players, like Dany has never defended a castle before. She's never had a castle before. She was always the aggressor in all of her battles. Like at the Loot Train attack, that was masterful, but it's very different charging at a bunch of unaware soldiers as it is defending a castle against a coming army. Jon successfully fended off Mance Rayder's wildling army for a night at Castle Black, but that was a while ago, and his recent war efforts in like the Battle of Bastards and Beyond the Wall left a lot to be desired. But Tyrion could prove his worth here, because his defense of King's Landing against Stannis' forces at the Blackwater might have been the best in the entire series. He had an innovative plan. He saw it through. He gave an inspirational speech. He basically saved the castle and held it long enough for his father's forces to win the battle, what might Tyrion be able to cook up for the White Walker attack, which they know is coming and they should be able to adequately prepare?
Yeah, I get a really weird feeling with Tyrion this season. You know, he has that conversation with Sansa where she says, "I used to believe you were the cleverest man alive." And he's kind of doing some Jon style brooding, really furrowing his brow. And Bran is there, and Bran just gives him a look. I guess Bran gives everyone a look, but
the same look.
It's just the same look all the time. But it felt like it was very deliberately placed, with Bran just staring up at Tyrion, and Tyrion, you know, thoughtfully and kind of conflictedly looking off. And if you go back and you watch, you know, even season 7 scenes with Tyrion and Daenerys, they just don't seem to really like each other or really get along. And so I wonder if they can kind of smooth over their relationship and get back on track as we kind of enter the end game, or if things will continue to split. But it feels like right now, I just don't know what they're doing with Tyrion's plot, and I'm really interested in it.
Well, you know, Dany's father famously did not get along all that well with Tyrion's father when Tywin was Aerys's hand. So there might be some precedence there. And I think that would be unfortunate because of how phenomenal a character Tyrion has been so far. I'd like him to have one last, you know, great moment, even if that eventually comes.
We should also mention that, you know, in this episode, they're going to all find out that Tyrion obviously got duped by his sister once again, but that also he will be in like the weird position of he will probably want to kind of be on Jaime's side and come to the defense of his brother. And so he's sort of going to be in like a really tough situation with Dany, and being like, one, look, I know I got owned, but it's okay. But, and two, also, like, this guy who killed your dad, like, I know him and he's not that bad. Like, it's going to be kind of in between a rock and a hard place for him in this episode.
So let's make some actual predictions. We've talked a lot about what we suspect might happen, but let's put our name to two predictions. Like last week, we're going to say one that we think will happen and one that might not be so likely, but that we really want to happen in this coming episode. So let's start, Riley. What do you think will happen?
All right, I kind of said this before, but I think that the Night King will not be at the Battle of Winterfell. You know, we see in the trailer that horse hoof come down. I think that that can't be the Night King because he has a new mount now. He rides a dragon, so he wouldn't be on a horse. I don't think it really makes sense. And since we've seen absolutely no visual evidence at all that the dragons are even near Winterfell in episode 2 or episode 3, I think that they're gonna leave. But perhaps the Night King is taking some of his army elsewhere. Perhaps he's taking Viserion and going on a solo mission somewhere. I just think that they're gonna find out in this episode that the Night King is not actually with his army, and that the army marching south is led solely by the White Walkers while the Night King is doing something else, which would really create a sense of panic when you figure, you know, not only do you have this existential threat marching down, but it's going to be in multiple places at once.
Okay, so my prediction for what I think will happen, it might disagree with yours or it might complement it, but I think that, you know, that shot in the end of the season 8 trailer where a White Walker undead horse sort of steps into the frame, paws the ground with its two front legs, and you can't see the rider, and then the trailer ends. And I think that will be how this episode ends too. We'll see everyone preparing. We'll see them looking out to see the army approaching. We'll see the shot of the horse as it steps into the frame. And then it'll cut to black as a cliffhanger, leaving fans to wait a week for the start of the battle. I would get chills at the end of that episode.
I'm with you 100%. I totally think that that's how this episode ends as well.
What do you want to happen?
What I want to happen is I want to never see Bronn again. And it's not because I don't like Bronn. I actually really like Bronn as a character. I want to never see him again because I think that it would be totally in his character to take that wagon of gold that Qyburn said was waiting for him and just say, you know what? Screw it. I'm not going to go kill Jaime or Tyrion. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to Dorne, or I'm going to go to Essos. I'm going to retire. I'm done. I'm out. And if we just episode after episode don't see him and then eventually are like, wait, what happened? Where is Bronn? And kind of all collectively realize that he just took that money and ran. I think it'd be hilarious and actually kind of a great end for his character.
Yeah, you'll notice we haven't touched on anything in King's Landing in this podcast episode because we didn't see any of it in the teaser for next week. So maybe we'll get some time off with the battle coming, but That'd be pretty funny if Bronn just never arrives and goes and finds his own castle and girl somewhere. What I want to see happen is a little darker, because I want a surprise death. Everything seems like it's building towards this big battle, and the only notable death last week was Ned Umber. Rest in peace, but he wasn't much of a name.
His family got Rickon killed.
I think everyone will remember Ned Umber for what happened to him after he died, as opposed to anything he did in life, which is sad. He was young, too young to go, but at least that was a cool image. So I would like to see some name character die this episode. Maybe a scouting party gets caught outside Winterfell, or maybe we end up unexpectedly in King's Landing for some drama with the Golden Company. But that would be, I think, an exciting propellant as the battle beckons 1 week away, that we expect this almost to be an eye of the storm of sorts. But to see a surprise there, I think, would shake things up a little bit.
I agree with you. I feel like we can't just save every character death for episode 3. We got to have a couple in, you know, we got to just spread them out. Maybe this episode, maybe episode 4, whenever, but not all in the Battle of Winterfell.
I'm sure we'll see a lot of character deaths. Maybe next week, assuming the battle's to come in episode 3, we'll do a prediction of like every character. Will they live or die in the Battle of Winterfell? Because I'm sure there will be a lot of deaths. But that's for next week. And this is all we have time for now. As always, don't forget to rate us 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have any questions or theories you want us to break down, right into therecapables@gmail.com, and we'll try to answer some when they make sense on the show. Be sure to read all of our written coverage on theringer.com this week. Riley broke down that Night King spiral message, and I analyzed Winterfell's defensive strengths and weaknesses. We also have articles about Tyrion, Bran, Dany, and many more. Of course, tune in to Talk the Thrones with Mal, Jason, and Chris, going live on Twitter every Sunday night after the episode. And we'll be back next week, likely to preview the Battle of Winterfell. Until then, Riley, enjoy episode 2, and may your bedtime stories be full of murder and vengeance.
Just how I like them. Thanks, Zach.